topic today surely shares that commonality, and we all have much to learn about the issues WikiLeaks has raised. Our speaker is a preeminent First Amendment lawyer. He is also a teacher, a commentator, and a keeper of the flame. Indeed, he was a key figure in designing the concept of First Amendment jurisprudence. Had James Goodale been there in Philadelphia in 1787 for the Constitutional Convention, he would have heard, with, I think, considerable discomfort. General George Washington, president of the convention, declaring in his opening remarks, quote, "Gentlemen, we will have no newspaper reporters attending our discussions, and the delegates will not talk to the press, because if you do, you will not be willing to change your minds on the issues, nor would you be willing to speak frankly in front of reporters," end quote. I paraphrase only slightly. That was his message, and he enforced it. The press was a player from the beginning, and it had been for more than a century during the colonial period in the form of small circulation newspapers. Mr. Goodale came along a little later. He graduated from Yale Law School in the late 1950s, spent a few years at Lord Day and Lord, the law firm representing the New York Times, and then in 1963, he joined the Times itself as its only in-house lawyer. In short order, he built a legal department, eventually became an executive VP and vice chairman of the company, and helped take the family-owned New York Times public. He also was intimately involved in the four cases that brought the New York Times before the Supreme Court. The first was New York Times versus Sullivan, which dealt with libel. The second, in 1971, was the Pentagon Papers case, which dealt with prior consent, or you could say censorship. On the Pentagon Papers case, the court ruled 6-3 in favor of the Times and the First Amendment, and Mr. Goodale had arrived. He seems never to have looked back. In 1980, he moved to Debevoise Plimpton, taking the Times with him as his client. And over the years, he's also represented the Hearst Corporation, NBC, Cablevision, Channel 13, public television, and take note, the NFL, NHL, and NBA, football, hockey, and basketball. Who needs tickets? James Goodale is also a prolific writer of articles and books, mostly on the press. And since 1977, he has been on the faculties of many law schools, Yale, NYU, New York Law, and Fordham among them. From 1995 to 2010, he produced and hosted his own public television show called The Digital Age, not surprisingly. In all, using many platforms, Mr. Goodale has taught hundreds and hundreds of lawyers how to practice First Amendment law. And he has encouraged them to do so with the example of his own remarkable career. Let me conclude by pointing out that James Goodale played varsity baseball and hockey as an undergraduate. He's often unreachable these days because he keeps in shape ice skating in New York Central Park. Hockey, I might add, is good preparation for the WikiLeaks debate, which begins, as they say on cable television, right now. Ladies and gentlemen, James Goodman.
Thank you all for coming. This is the first time I've been here. This is just one great campus, one great college, one great faculty, and if I'd met more undergraduates, or any, in fact, I would say great undergraduates, which I'm sure is the case. Thanks a lot for having me. I think probably Stanley's remarks about my ice skating proclivities, for those of you who live in this climate, probably falls on deaf ears. I hope that my talk on Julian Assange does not fall on deaf ears, because it's about to break again. He's about to be in the news again, and it's, for me, a very exciting time. Now, you heard all the mention of law cases, law this and law that. I want to use this occasion to tell you of the story of Julian Assange, because I think that many of the threads of the story have been lost. And I think it would be fun to sort of see what it was all about, what it's about today, and then we can get to the First Amendment question, which, if you can guess, you probably can guess what my answer is. Okay, let's start off with WikiLeaks. Now, if I slip into Wikipedia, it's only because I use Wikipedia all the time. If I say Wikimedia, that's because what I think the media has come. But all of you know what wiki means, at least you should, which is that if you go on Wikipedia, for example, you are part of the process. You are able to create and make whatever comes out on Wikipedia. And Wikimedia, and WikiLeaks, which is formed by Julian Assange, you can do the same thing. He has a website that is a receptacle for information from people who wish to leak secret information. It is there to keep the identity of the person who leaks the information secret. When it started, the leaker could participate on what was on the website. That has changed. Now, the website is just there for Julian Assange. Who is Julian Assange? Well, Julian Assange was an Australian who moved to Europe to start WikiLeaks, which is a website, technically. It is located in Sweden because Sweden has very good laws that protect sources of those who give information to WikiLeaks. He started in 2006 with WikiLeaks. In the first years of WikiLeaks, we didn't hear very much about it. In the years 2007, 2008, and 2009, he was starting up. He ran some information that was quite important. He ran information about an election that influenced the election in Kenya. He ran information about those who had died during the Iraq War. That number had never previously been disclosed. He ran information about a nuclear mishap in Iran. Those were his major contributions for the 3 years in question. He hit the big time in 2010. He hit the big time because he met through some process, we'll get back to exactly how he met the gentleman I'm about to describe to you, Private Manning. Private Manning was in the Intelligence Corps of the United States Army, and he had access to secret documents, mostly secret, not top secret. Now, what Manning did was, he took the secret documents, he downloaded them, you all downloaded, you know what that means. They were encrypted when they first came to Manning. He would decrypt them, and then put the decrypted material in a receptacle, effectively, which made him able to deliver it to people who would have interest in what he had. The first such decrypted email, I think, in fact, is what it was, involved a shooting of a Reuters reporter by a helicopter in Iraq. And this hit the headlines. But that was little compared to what was to come. In the balance of 2010, he released information about Afghanistan and information about the diplomatic cables that he had access to. With respect to the information that he released about Afghanistan, they became known as the Afghanistan war logs. This is how he did it. He had all the information that Manning had given. It came in encrypted form. He decrypted it. He sent it to Assange. Now, what Assange did thereafter was different than what he'd done before. What he did at that point was he got in touch with Der Spiegel, that's a German newspaper, the New York Times, and the Guardian, that's an English newspaper. And he said, hey guys, look, I've got material that you would have a great interest in with respect to Afghanistan and with respect to diplomatic cables. Those two events were actually separated, but I'm putting them together for ease of conversation. I want you to look at them and see if you want to release them. You make your own decision with respect to what you're going to do. And once you've made your decision, then I'll decide what to do. So, what those three newspapers did was they released the information that, with respect to the Afghan warlocks and to the diplomatic cables, all at the same time. And then once that information had been released, then Assange released it. Now, what was in the Afghan warlocks? I have to tell you, Assange has released so much material, thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of email, that the truth of the matter is no one knows exactly what is released. What we know is what we can take the time to find on the net, or what we know is from the reports in the newspapers to which I describe. Here's generally, without going into any great detail, what the Afghan logs told us. They told us that Pakistan was heavily involved in the Afghan war. This came as a shocker. We didn't know it at the time. We know it today, don't we? But we didn't know it at the time. They told us that the drones that were put in place to get terrorists, after all, Al-Qaeda, were being used in a domestic war in Afghanistan. They told us that there was a death squad of U.S. Soldiers, NATO soldiers, that went around and killed suspected terrorists in Afghanistan. We didn't know that. With respect to the diplomatic cables were of a different sort. And I must say there are millions and millions of these diplomatic cables. You couldn't read them all if you tried. What the diplomatic cables described pretty much was the daily life of what went on in diplomats when they're in countries. They serve. The diplomats send back information about the countries to Washington, D.C. These cables were not particularly offensive in my view, not shared by everybody, but in my view. They would say such things as, the Canadians have an inferiority complex. Saudi Arabia, we want you to attack Iraq, a little more serious, but not that serious when you stop to think about it. The Chinese are behind breaking into the computers in the United States, a little bit more serious, but not as serious. Some other things you can think of. More importantly, with respect to Tunisia and with respect to Libya, they describe the activities of the people who govern those two countries and describe them in no flattering terms whatsoever, and very unflattering terms. What was the impact of each of these? Take the diplomatic cables first. Diplomatic cables are thought to have played a major role, in the Arab Spring, particularly in Tunisia and particularly in Libya. Everyone was so shocked as to what was being said about the leaders of those two countries, disclosing information that people hadn't had before. It energized them to start the Arab Spring. That's a very important result. The other impact of the diplomatic cables, with all due respects, does not seem to be that earth-shaking with respect to its impact on national security. That view not held by everybody. When the Afghan cables came out, by comparison, the Secretary of Defense was quite concerned that the Afghan cables would disclose sources for whatever military actions that were going to take place, and he was very unhappy about it. When the diplomatic cables came out, the Secretary of Defense took an entirely different approach. He said, I think they're harmless. Interesting. But Joe Lieberman, Senator Joe Lieberman, did not think they were so harmless. He said the New York Times the Guardian and Der Spiegel have blood on their hands. What he did was, he then got in touch with PayPal and with MasterCard and the other credit companies that were supporting Julian Assange by taking contributions for Julian Assange. He was a charitable group, a nonprofit group, and people wished to support him would use PayPal and MasterCard, and he turned off a lot of the money that went to Julian Assange. Now, we're going to see effectively what the impact of all of that is on what happened to Julian Assange thereafter and to Private Bradley Manning. Here's what happened there. Okay, so now the law comes to play. Bradley Manning is in the Army. He's subject to Army discipline and Army laws, military laws. Julian Assange is not. Bradley Manning was immediately arrested. He was charged under the Uniform Code of Military Justice for aiding and abetting the enemy. He was charged under the Espionage Act and the Computer Act. I'll tell you a little bit about the Espionage Act in a second. With respect to Julian Assange, and here the tale gets a little bit more murky because he's in and out of the courts and you don't know exactly what's happening to him. I'm going to tell you in a few minutes something's about to happen to him, which makes all of what I have to say even more important than perhaps I think it is. With respect to Julian Assange, the first thing that happened to him was he was charged in Sweden for inappropriate sexual behavior. And I don't think I'll go into the details, so we'll just leave it at that. And that charge was carried over to England, where Julian Assange was presently residing. He was asked by the Swedish authorities, with respect to that charge, to be extradited from the UK to Sweden. Now, so what, you might say? Well, as I will tell you in a few minutes, there's a US connection to all of this. In any event, he was then tried, or his case was heard in a trial court in the UK. Should he be extradited or not? He said, I shouldn't be extradited because you know what's going to happen to me? I'm going to be extradited to Sweden. As soon as I get to Sweden, Sweden's going to ship me off to the United States, and that'll be the end of me. I'll end up in Guantanamo. He lost. He appealed the case. He lost. He appealed the case to the Supreme Court of the UK in February. That court has now had the case for a couple of months. All of us who have followed the case think that they're going to come down, that court's going to come down with a decision pretty quickly. In other words, let's say in the next 30 or 40 days. And when that happens, the fat will be in the fire with respect to Julian Assange and to what ultimately happens to him. I think, and others who have looked at the case believe, that the British court will indeed send him back to Sweden. When he gets back to Sweden, and this may happen in the next 30 or 60 days, all hell will break loose because Assange's lawyers will get up and say, I can't be extradited because I'm a political prisoner and hear my case and keep me in Sweden. We'll see if indeed that happens. Now, the other thing that happened, we've talked about Bradley Manning here in the U.S. and we talked about Assange in the U.K. and we've talked about the Swedish courts and what they might do, is that in the United States, when WikiLeaks came out and after Senator Joe Lieberman said the New York Times and everyone else has blood on their hands, what happened was that the United States government, this would be President Obama and the Attorney General, Mr. Holder, put into place a grand jury to indict Assange. And so there is sitting now in Virginia a grand jury that is ready to indict Assange once Assange comes into this country. If that grand jury indicts Assange, then we're going to have the case of the century under the First Amendment. And that's what I'm here to talk about in some part today. You've got to understand why this grand jury was put in place. There's some obvious reasons which I've already discussed. But one reason that you may not have appreciated is that President Obama is, from a press point of view, the worst national security president the press has ever known. I'm an Obama supporter, and it pains me to tell you that. But he is a national security hawk. That's quite popular. Perhaps he should be a national security hawk. He said that he's going to run for presidency on his national security record, perhaps as a national security hawk. He has indicted more leakers during his term of presidency than has any other president in the United States. History. History. And I'll tell you why indicting and using the criminal process for leaking is a little unusual in just one second. But the numbers go something like this. In the previous history of the United States, before the Pentagon Papers case. Now, I was in the Pentagon Papers case. I'll tell you some about it later. And so when I say those magic words, you know, I think everyone knows all about it. But when it happened, I have students in law school, they don't know all about it. They particularly don't know when it happened. But anyway, when it happened, I like to say when things happened in the in my era, that it happened in the last century. Almost the middle of the last century, not quite, in 1971. At the time of 1971, when Daniel Ellsberg, more about him later, leaked the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times, there had never been a prosecution for leaking. I'll tell you why in a minute. But leaks just took place. People lived with them. No one had a nervous breakdown over them. And they were sort of part of the way you did things in Washington. So much information was classified, people in the ordinary course would tell them, my friend Stanley Flink, did you hear about this and that and the other thing? And it turned out that this, that, and the other thing would be classified. Perhaps Stanley Flink would know about it, perhaps he wouldn't. But there was just tons of leaking that went on before 1971, and to this day. Do you know today there are 4 million people who have access to classified information? 4 million people. That's an awful lot of people to have access to classified information and not expect that somehow something's going to leak out from them to the press. Obama, in his first year of his presidency, classified 77 million documents. Now, how in the world can there be 77 million documents that have classified information that is necessary to be retained by the government in them? It's improbable. In Bush's last year, he had classified 44 million documents. So my point about Obama is that he is a national security hawk with respect to classification. Now, I said that until the Pentagon Papers, there had been no indictments of people who leaked. Ellsberg, who was the leaker, he was indicted. He got off, so to speak, because Nixon had broken into his private office, and the court hearing his case said, I don't want to hear it. After that, before Obama came in, there were two other instances of indictments for leaking. Now, President Obama has indicted six or seven people for leaking in the 3+ years he's had the presidency. And with that background, it makes me worry a little bit what's going to happen down the line with Assange. Now, why is it that we had not had indictments for leaks in the past? As I've indicated in the past, because it was part of the normal conversation that takes place in Washington, D.C. When I made that statement in making previous talks of this sort, I look out at the audience, and the audience usually doesn't believe me. In fact, when I first started this field, I didn't believe it either. But the fact of the matter is, there's so much information, as I've said before, that's subject to classification. It leaks out, it's inevitable, and it's necessary. I'll come back to that point. Now, there is no law that says you can't leak, or if you were to receive a leak, that you can be prosecuted for. There's no law as such. What there is a law called the Espionage Act. The Espionage Act, believe it or not, covers espionage. It says right on the top, espionage. It doesn't cover leaks. Now, the Espionage Act was used in the Pentagon Papers case to stop the New York Times from publishing the Pentagon Papers. More about that in a minute. But the Espionage Act, all it says is if you communicate information relating to the national defense to the enemy with an intent to harm the United States, you can be put in the can for espionage. Makes sense. If you are subject to the rules of classification, that is to say, you can look at classification material, you've been authorized to do it, you obviously cannot take that information and run over to the Russians or the Iraqis or the Iranians, say, here it is. That is espionage. But leaking is not espionage. Leaking is part of the conversation the government has with the press, and it's for the purposes of informing the public. So that is why we have not had any prosecutions under the Espionage Act. Okay, a little water, we'll get back to the song.